Welcome to another deep dive.
Yeah, glad to be here. We have a lot to get through.
We really do. And I have to say, looking at the stack of historical sources we have today, it really acts as a direct time machine.
It absolutely does.
For you listening, we're going to be looking at the 1916 editions of a newspaper called The Equity.
Right.
And this was the local paper for Shawville, which is a town located in the Pontiac region of Quebec.
Quebec, Canada, yeah. And, you know, it provides this remarkably unfiltered window into the past.
It really does.
Because we usually study history from the top down.
Right.
Right? You read about national policies or massive troop movement.
The strategic decisions of generals, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But looking at macro history through a micro lens, like a small town newspaper, it helps us truly understand the human experience of a global conflict.
Yeah, how those massive historical currents actually just wash over a single tight-knit community. So let's unpack this, because the mission of this deep dive today is to uncover the reality of World War I, but absolutely not from the muddy trenches of Europe.
Right, a totally different perspective.
We want to explore how this immense global conflict reshaped the daily lives and the local economy of the Pontiac region.
And we're also going to look at the specific and sometimes incredibly tense dynamics between English and French Canadians regarding the war effort.
Yeah, that part gets really intense. But just starting off, when you open the pages of these 1916 editions, the visual layout alone tells just a jarring story.
Oh, it's wild. The shadow of the war is omnipresent, but it is deeply intertwined with the completely mundane realities of daily life.
Because they couldn't just press pause, right?
Exactly. The community didn't have the luxury of pressing pause on their existence just because a war was happening across the ocean.
So imagine you were sitting at your kitchen table in 1916 reading the local paper. You see a casualty list printed right next to an advertisement for the upcoming Shawville Fair.
Or a notice for a church picnic.
Yeah. The paper actually explicitly notes how the shadow of an abiding sorrow began to darken many homes as these lists arrived by telegraph.
And they are listing local boys, names everybody in town knew.
You have Peter Sullivan from Sheenborough and Arthur Derosier of Fort Collange, printed right alongside everyday cheerful ads for Kodaks and Kodak film.
The psychological whiplash of that layout is profound. You have the ultimate tragedy of human existence placed side by side with the price of baking powder.
It's hard to wrap your head around.
It is. What's fascinating here is how the community had to process this immense rolling grief without stopping the machinery of their daily lives. They had to mourn Peter and Arthur while still bringing in the harvest.
While still running the local shops.
Exactly.
And reading through these pages, you see, it wasn't just the news of the casualties that hurt the community. It was how the military machinery actually treated their local boys once they enlisted.
Yes.
Which brings us to the heartbreak of the 77th Battalion.
This is a local unit.
Yeah, a local unit. The community watched these boys sign up together. They trained together. They left for Europe as a cohesive group of friends, brothers, neighbors.
And the moment they got to England,
the commanding officer simply broke up the unit just to fill gaps in other decimated ranks.
This raises a crucial point about how military logic clashed with human reality. In 1916, local battalions were incredibly common.
Right.
The idea was that men would fight harder if they were standing shoulder to shoulder with the guy they grew up with.
Makes sense.
But the casualties on the front lines were so horrific that the British High Command treated incoming units like spare parts. They just stripped the 77th Battalion for parts to patch holes in a broken line.
And we actually have a specific, incredibly poignant letter printed in the paper that captures the devastation of that decision.
It's from Corporal Stanley Grant, right?
Yes, written to his brother back home in the Pontiac. And he describes the agonizing reality of the separation.
What does he say?
He writes, quote, "We did not even bring our officers. We did not even bring our colonel. I must say it was hard to leave the boys. There were sure some sights when we left there. The fellows who were left behind cried like babies when we left. When we arrived in France, we were again split up into small units. Even brothers were parted."
Wow. Think about the psychological shock of having those community bonds severed the very moment they reached the staging grounds.
Yeah, because they enlisted relying on that shared trust.
Exactly, that local solidarity.
Yeah.
To be stripped of your officers, your friends, and literally your own brothers, and then fed into a massive, impersonal military machine as an interchangeable cog.
The loss of morale must have been devastating.
Oh, without a doubt.
Now, Corporal Grant does mention he was lucky to eventually get grouped with two friends, but his letter really underscores how these men were just numbers on a ledger to the high command.
They really were.
But speaking of how Canada was used to patch holes, here's where it gets really interesting. Because not all the soldiers from this region were sent over to shoot rifles.
No, they were not. We see fascinating reports in the paper about the Axemen of Canada.
The Axemen of Canada?
Yes. Because of a severe timber shortage in Great Britain, a special battalion of 1,500 Canadian woodsmen was formed.
Including French-Canadian axemen from regions just like the Pontiac.
Right.
I found this detail so surprising. You get deployed to a war zone in Europe. You are given the standard military organization. You are dressed in the standard khaki uniform.
But your primary weapon is an axe.
An axe.
It's a perfect example of how war is a machine that devours all resources, not just ammunition. Great Britain was desperate for lumber.
For the trenches, right.
Exactly. Trench warfare meant they needed endless supplies of wood for duck boards to line the muddy trenches, for shoring up defensive walls, and for building temporary railways to move artillery.
So Canada's greatest asset wasn't just troops.
No, it was rugged physical labor and forestry expertise.
And the places they sent these axemen are incredible. They deployed entire Canadian lumber camps. The men, their own machinery brought over from Canada, their specific logging methods, right into the ancient crown timber reserves of England.
They were chopping down historic ancient woodlands like Windsor Great Park to feed the war effort.
Imagine the visual of Canadian lumberjacks setting up a rugged logging camp in the middle of the king's manicured, centuries-old royal estate.
It really highlights the absolute desperation of the British war effort by 1916.
But while those men were clear-cutting Windsor Great Park, the labor vacuum they left behind created a massive crisis back home.
It did.
The home front hustle in the Pontiac region was facing a severe immediate problem. The newspapers are boasting about a bumper wheat crop that year.
The weather cooperated, the yield was fantastic.
But there was a massive lack of farmhands to actually harvest it. The young men were all in Europe. The community is practically begging for laborers in these pages.
Which triggers an intense economic shockwave locally. You have crops rotting in the field because the physical labor force has been exported.
The local ads really reflect a community experiencing total economic whiplash. The market realities printed in these pages are wild to read.
What did you find?
Well, on one page, you have locals celebrating a 50-cent drop in the price of Lantic sugar.
Which was a huge deal back then.
Massive deal. For context for listening, Lantic sugar was a major Canadian household staple, and a price drop meant families could afford to preserve fruits for the winter.
Right.
But right next to that celebration, local merchants are running urgent, almost panicked warnings telling people to buy their dry goods immediately before prices skyrocket.
Because the supply chains were collapsing under the weight of the war.
Exactly.
The Canadian Pacific Railway, the CPR, was heavily prioritizing military movement. Moving troops and munitions took precedence over everything else.
Which meant regular travel and the shipping of everyday commercial goods into rural areas like the Pontiac was becoming incredibly difficult and unpredictable.
And looking at these sources, it's striking how raw the politics got under all this strain.
Yes. And actually, just as a quick heads up to you listening, we are acting strictly as historical observers today.
Absolutely.
We are about to look at the political and cultural fault lines regarding English and French-Canadian perceptions of the war, exactly as they were printed in the Equity.
We're just observing the friction. We're not taking sides or endorsing these historical viewpoints.
That is a crucial baseline to establish. Because the friction visible on these pages was intense.
A community suffering from economic instability, labor shortages, and immense grief is a highly combustible environment.
Definitely.
What the sources show is a region deeply fractured along linguistic and cultural lines regarding who was bearing the brunt of the enlistment burden.
You see that enlistment divide highlighted in a very specific report published by the paper. They feature comments from a French army captain named Auguste Bubet. He was actually recovering from his wounds in Toronto, having served in the French army since the very beginning of the war. And during an interview, he expressed public regret that there were still able-bodied Frenchmen of military age in Canada who had not answered their country's call.
Publishing a quote like that in an English-language newspaper in a culturally mixed region like the Pontiac is highly provocative.
It's throwing a match on gasoline.
Exactly. You have to understand the underlying demographics. The English-speaking population generally felt a strong imperial tie to Britain. They were enlisting in high numbers and suffering heavy casualties as a result.
So reading quotes from a wounded French officer essentially calling out French Canadians for not enlisting at the same rate,
it would immediately validate and inflame local English frustrations.
The cultural friction got so heated across the country that it reached the absolute highest levels of the Catholic Church.
This part is fascinating.
The paper reports that the Pope himself had to intervene in Canadian politics. The Vatican gave explicit orders to the province of Quebec that church leaders must neither speak nor write a single word touching the language issue in Canada.
When the Vatican has to issue a formal gag order to cool down local linguistic tensions, the situation has clearly reached a boiling point.
No kidding.
The Catholic Church simply could not afford to have its English and French-speaking congregations in Canada tearing each other apart over wartime politics.
War acts as a pressure cooker.
It does. It takes the existing cracks in a society like the long-standing linguistic divides in Quebec and forces them wide open.
And the editors of the Equity were absolutely participating in that pressure cooker. You see, direct political sniping in the paper aimed at the former prime minister, Sir Wilfrid Laurier.
Yes, over his pre-war declarations.
Right. They specifically reprinted his quotes from 1912 and 1913, where he argued against building up a Canadian navy because he denied there was any naval emergency.
And then the paper asks, incredibly sarcastically,
how do they read now?
It is the ultimate political "I told you so," weaponized during a time of mass casualties.
It's brutal.
The editors are using the grief and the fear of the community to settle old political scores, pointing fingers at politicians they deem insufficiently patriotic or historically short-sighted.
It really reflects a community desperately looking for someone to blame for their current suffering.
So how does a person living in the Pontiac in 1916 actually cope with all this? The casualties, the labor shortages, the Pope having to silence their local priests?
It leads to this strange normalcy, these surreal contrasts we see in the final sections of our sources. People just find a way to keep going.
Because the human mind can only sustain a state of pure adrenaline-fueled panic for so long. Eventually, it has to revert to the mundane to survive.
You see a desperate clinging to tradition as a coping mechanism.
And the traditions are incredibly specific. While the world is literally on fire, the locals are still holding their annual Orange Order demonstrations on July 12th.
Which, for context for you listening, the Orange Order is a Protestant political society.
Which adds a whole other layer of tension, considering the English Protestant and French Catholic divides we just talked about.
Yeah, exactly. But beyond that, they are actively planning the Shawville Fair.
They're giving out cash prizes for the best half bushel of potatoes.
They are hosting a ladies' driving contest featuring a single horse and a four-wheeled rig.
They're organizing local church socials just to buy a new piano for the choir.
Those events are anchors. They remind the community who they are outside of the war.
But even within those anchors, the fabric of their society is visibly changing. Take the local Red Cross ladies mentioned in the paper.
Oh, this is a great detail.
The article details how they went door to door, collecting funds for the war effort. And it explicitly notes that they faced many rebuffs, but stubbornly succeeded in raising a substantial sum anyway.
I found the phrase "many rebuffs" so striking. These women are walking up to their neighbors' homes to ask for Red Cross donations, and people are literally shutting the door in their faces.
It shows how the political friction and the economic strain were playing out face to face on their front porches.
It wasn't just abstract political debates.
No. And beyond the friction, those women represent the beginning of a massive societal shift. With so many men gone to the trenches or the logging camps, women are stepping up and taking on entirely new public and financial roles.
They are organizing community fundraisers, managing agricultural logistics, knocking on doors, making public demands of their neighbors.
It is a quiet revolution happening in the background, fundamentally altering the gender dynamics of the town.
But the background noise of the paper wasn't always quiet or subtle. There was absolute outrage printed over a report from an internment camp for alien enemies located in Halifax.
Yes.
The camp was in the Halifax Citadel, which is a massive historic star fort. The report detailed how these interned prisoners were living incredibly comfortably inside the fort.
Too comfortably, according to the paper.
Way too comfortably. They were enjoying the beautiful scenery of the harbor. They were playing tennis.
One German officer even boasted to the press that they had a much better time in Halifax than prisoners did back in Germany.
You have to analyze how a report like that lands in Shawville. Imagine you are a parent whose son is sleeping in the freezing mud of France.
Or perhaps you've just received a casualty notice for your brother.
And then you open your local paper and read that the so-called enemy is essentially on a scenic vacation, playing tennis on the Canadian government's dime.
It feels like a profound cosmic injustice. It would absolutely infuriate a grieving community that is struggling just to afford Atlantic sugar.
It's a massive psychological insult. And as if the distant war wasn't causing enough trauma, the community was simultaneously hit with a devastating domestic tragedy.
The Great Fire of 1916.
Massive forest fires up in northern Ontario and Quebec that wiped out entire towns and killed around 200 people.
And for the folks in Shawville, these weren't just distant dots on a map. They were neighboring regions up north where their own relatives had moved for lumber work.
The scale of that fire was staggering. It consumed an area of over 1,500 square miles. Towns like Matheson and Nooshka were practically wiped off the map in a matter of hours.
The sheer apocalyptic nature of a fire that size, happening while a global war is raging, it must have felt like the end of the world.
The human stories printed from the ashes of that fire are heartbreaking. The paper details the journey of a local woman, Mrs. Eugene Dimmers.
Right.
She heard about the fire and was terrified for her brother, William Bertrand, who was up north working in Nooshka. She eventually got word that he was among the dead.
So what did she do?
She traveled all the way north to the burnt, smoldering ruins of the town just to locate the temporary mass grave where he had been buried. And she had his remains exhumed so she could have him properly interred in a Catholic cemetery.
It is a profound testament to human resilience and the deep driving need for closure. Even in the midst of apocalyptic conditions, this woman traveled into a disaster zone to ensure her brother had his dignity.
Yeah, and yet, even amid all the surrounding death from the trenches and the forest fires, the paper also makes a point to report on the silver linings.
Which is surprising.
It is. Specifically, they focus on the rapid advancement of medicine. I was really surprised to see medical miracles making the front pages.
They feature a detailed article on Sir Almroth Wright's saline irrigation for wounds.
Right. Doctors figured out that using a 10% saltwater solution helped clean and heal severe battlefield wounds in just a few days by drawing out the poison.
They were also writing about using paraffin sprays to treat severe burns, which was incredibly relevant given both the artillery burns in Europe and the forest fires back home.
It shows how war, for all its unparalleled horror, acts as a brutal catalyst for life-saving innovations.
The sheer volume of unprecedented casualties forced doctors and scientists to invent new methods on the fly.
And these medical advancements, born out of necessity in the trenches, would eventually benefit the civilian world and save countless lives in the decades to follow.
It really is a massive amount of history to absorb from just a few editions of a local newspaper.
It is. Which brings us to the end of our deep dive today. And I want to turn this over to you, our listener. What stands out to you from all of this?
Yeah, think about how macro history is truly lived at the micro level.
We've just walked through the story of a small town balancing immense, unspeakable grief, intense cultural and linguistic tensions, and the completely mundane necessity of hosting a potato contest at the local fair.
It really is a profound juxtaposition of the human experience. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Something that builds on these 1916 sources, but looks just over the horizon.
Okay.
Think about the moment when the surviving young men finally returned from the trenches to the Pontiac region.
Right. When the war ends.
Yes. They had seen the absolute horrors of the world. But consider the community they are returning to. How does a town ever go back to normal when the women have taken over the economy? When cultural divides have been laid completely bare? And when the very fabric of their local identity has been irrevocably altered by those who stayed behind.
The town they left wasn't the town they were coming back to?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The soldiers changed, but so did the home they were fighting for.
That is an incredible point to end on. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today. Keep questioning, keep learning, and we will catch you next time.